one's going to come to you asking for your trillion dollar idea. Yeah. Show idea. You know, you need to make it happen, and it's not easy, but that's where the scrappiness comes in.
Hello and welcome along to another episode of the Kids Media Club podcast from a beautifully sunny afternoon in London. Andy, who have we got with us today?
So we're delighted to be joined by Emily Brundage, show creator, writer and showrunner. Emily, if you could kick things off just by kind of giving us a bit of an introduction and telling us a bit about what you've been working on.
Yeah, so I got my start with a YouTube series in 2012 called Pubertina that got millions of views. And that was kind of my introduction to the animation industry. I then was invited to pitch all around town, pitch shows. I've sold 8 original shows in my career, and I was head writer on Hilda season 3, head writer on a show called Big Nate on Paramount Plus. And most recently, I created a show called Goldie for Apple TV Plus that was based on a short called Goldie that I independently produced. And it's now on Apple TV Plus. And then also this past year, I started writing a book that's called A Guide to Developing Animated Shows. And I basically put everything I know from my experience in development into a book. And, you know, I people reach out to me all the time, aspiring creators asking to get coffee. And obviously, I can't get coffee with everyone. So I thought this was a way for people to have that resource. And I would be compensated for it, too.
Yeah. Amazing. I can think of no other time to corral all of that knowledge together, given that the industry is going through such a transformation. But take us back to 2012 and that Pubertina on YouTube. I mean, that was in the early days of YouTube first and YouTube originals. So really blazing a trail there. Tell us about how you went through creating Pubertina for YouTube, digital first,
back in 2012. That was one of the first animated channels, I think. So I was a student at CalArts, the famous animation school or program. I was in grad school, though, and I created a short called Pubertina that was like a scrappy student short. I had no prior experience in animation. But I think what made it stand out was the song that I wrote and sang and for it. And then a producer happened to be in the audience at a showcase where the short was shown, and she saw something in it, and she was heading up helping recruit creators for this new channel that was created by the Smosh team, comedy team, Ian and Anthony. And they were looking for one, at least one female driven. So they saw me as a potential fit for that. And then I didn't know what I was doing. I never pitched a show before, but I just put together like a 2-page pitch document, and I pitched it to Barry Blumberg, who at the time was running Smosh or running Shut Up Cartoons. And they said, great, okay, here's $30,000, then we need you to make 10 episodes. And I had like a three-week turnaround or something like that. So I very quickly, I had been interning at Titmouse, so I hired my friend who I sat next to and cleaned up his drawings, and I asked him to be the animator, and different friends, basically, that I asked to be a part of it. And it was a very good training ground for me. because it was a pretty brutal production schedule and I was learning as I was going. But it definitely hit a nerve, the series, good and bad. Smosh had largely a male, young male following. So initially, Pubertina just got so much hate from probably a bunch of 10-year-old boys on the internet. But at the time, you didn't have to give your name to YouTube. So it was pretty anonymous. And that was a little scary. So I would get death threats. And Wow. Yeah, because of this cartoon about a girl going through puberty.
That's crazy.
And it was very shocking to me because I had never put anything of my work out there like that. And never experienced that. I consider myself to be a part of the first wave of internet hate.
Wow.
YouTube hate. And I wear it as a badge of honor, though.
Yeah, you should. I mean, that feels like it's kind of both. When you're first describing the production schedule, it sounded like an animation boot camp. And then the reaction to the show felt like it was kind of your baptism of fire, really.
And, amazing. You know, I really do think that whenever there's that strong of a reaction, whether it's good or bad, it's a good thing. But also, there was a huge female following who loved the show, mostly female and more sensitive guys and some gay kids who didn't know they were gay yet, who loved the series and would write to me. And I had a Twitter presence as Pubertina. Right. So I would write as Pubertina. Yeah. And I was very interactive with the fans. Like I would draw drawings of them as Pubertina, like love Pubertina. And there was a point where I said, if you love, they started calling themselves Puber Leavers. And I said, if you love Pubertina, draw a bleeding heart on your hand. And so they would take pictures of their marker drawings of bleeding hearts.
So you were at the forefront of that creator wave, and unusually a creator that was an animator well.
I should have kept with it. Look where I would be now. But instead, I went in the direction, the traditional direction of the studios. And
And just to kind of explore, because that the production schedule sounds kind of intense.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that in terms of, so I'm assuming that you wrote the episodes, the animation team was it just one animator or?
One animator, but then I had to bring on a lot of freelance animators to help. Yeah.
And then the voice cast,
I did the main voice.
Right.
And I, Pubertina, and I did a lot of the voices and then I hired friends to do the other voices.
Wow.
Originally, I wanted Maria Bamford for Pubertina, the comedian.
Yeah.
But her manager told me she was too busy.
What kind of a reaction did you get when you went the other way into the studio system from having a very creator-like start to your career? What reception did you get once you went into the more established studio system?
Well, they were very warm towards me, very friendly, because there was a lot of buzz around Pubertina. So they were eager to work with me. And that helped initially sell some show ideas that didn't go forward, but just get my foot in the door. And I got my first writing job from Pubertina on Star versus the Forces of Evil at Disney. And then I kind of, instead of going on a storyboard track, which I really wasn't a good storyboard artist. I was a stronger writer. So once I figured that out, I just pursued getting writing jobs in animation, which, by the way, I didn't know existed before entering the industry. I didn't know there were writing jobs in animation.
Interesting how we've come full circle in the decade since then. given that a lot of those established streamers now look to creators on YouTube and bring them in-house. You did it over 12 years ago.
Let's go forward to now. Most recently, I created the show Goldie, which was based on a short that was on YouTube. I also entered into many festivals and it toured all over the world before I pitched it to Apple. I think it was more warmly received because they had seen the short and seen the accolades that the short got. So I think that helped sell the show because it communicated my vision for it so clearly. And that's kind of become my strategy. As a writer, since I am not just a writer, I'm like a creator, an artist. I write songs. I'm not satisfied with just writing a script.
Yeah.
Or even writing a script I really love. I just have the urge, the drive to see it be executed in some way. Most recently, I created a Kickstarter for a show that I had pitched to one studio a while ago, but it's pretty weird. And it's based on my family history. It's about an immigrant vampire family moving to America. Mm. And so I decided, you know what? I'm just going to make it happen. I want to make this project happen. And I got my full funding to make a 11-minute pilot animatic. One scene will be animated by Mercury, who did Goldie in Canada. And as far the next chapter, once I finish it, is figuring out where it will live on YouTube.
That's amazing. Do you think that you're, because it feels like all the thing that connects all of those shows is the fact that you kind of went out and you created the original kind of episode that was really the touchstone of the Rosetta Stone of kind of what that show was about. With your experience with Goldie, having created that before taking it to Apple, did it also help with the production process in terms of sort of protecting the core of that idea because it already pre-existed the development?
Absolutely, Andy. Absolutely. So I came in there with the ability to say, and because it's a good looking short. I mean, if it wasn't, then I couldn't, push for it as much. But because it was such a beautiful short, the art direction and everything, and it was in my vision pretty much. We just went from there and they were happy to do that. They just wanted to elevate it. They kept using the word elevate. To Apple standards, but my crew at Mercury used it as a jumping off point for sure. And my art director, Ross Love, basically built out the world based on the information from the short.
And as a blueprint for creators who are perhaps frustrated by the industry challenges, what advice would you give, where to get started? You creators such as yourselves who are not having much luck with commissioners and pitching and doing the rounds of conferences. What's the first bit of advice you would give them?
I've been talking about this a lot, actually. I just talked to a class of college students at Pratt in New York yesterday. And what I would say, and this is what I did starting out, is I really hustled. I really advocated for myself. I showed up at every animation event I could in LA. I put myself in the circles of people who are already working in animation. I crashed the Animation Guild holiday party. you know, and really, I think that's what you need to do. You know, no one's going to come to you asking for your trillion dollar idea, show idea. You know, you need to make it happen. And it's not easy, but you need to, that's where the scrappiness comes in. That's where the reaching out to people, collaborators, you know, like if there's someone you like on YouTube who's not super successful, you know, but you like their art, you like their animation, there's no reason why you can't try to reach out to them and ask if they want to be a part of your project. The thing I would recommend, though, is to try to get some kind of budget for your project, because it's first of all, I just think it's more fair that way.
How do you, sorry to interrupt, Emily, how do you go about doing that for those that don't know where to start?
Well, one thing you can do is start a savings that's just towards your short, put aside a certain amount of money, like as if you would for an investment for a retirement fund, you know? Yeah. And eventually when you have like, say, $5,000 at least, I think you could start reaching out. I made my Goldie short for about $4,000, which is not much.
And what was the duration of the short?
It was a little over 3 minutes.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's a lot of work. But I found an animator who was both really good and really fast, which isn't, you know, common. Really? But I would say either that or you can do a Kickstarter or something like that, like I did for Strawberry Vampire, my project. And, you know, that's a little harder if you're not a well-connected person to get that kind of support. I felt like I had never done it before. And I felt like at this point in my career, I had permission. I gave myself permission to ask for money from people to do it. Because I felt like I had earned it. I had never done that before. So I felt like I wasn't abusing, you know, anything. But
I think, I mean, all of the shows that you've been talking about as well, it feels like you approach them from the point of view, I mean, particularly with kind of your original YouTube series, from the point of view of what resources do you have that you can kind of make use of. So I think sometimes people that want to get into creating the shows, they sometimes have unrealistic ideas of kind of what they can do at that point, whereas it feels like you've really built it from what you had access to and you've kind of continued mindset.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, people think they're gonna get to make a full show at first, and I would recommend starting smaller, like with even a 2 minute short, you know. And for example, just to show how I also keep this in mind with my latest Kickstarter, I wasn't trying to fund an 11 minute animated pilot. I would have been worried that I wouldn't get the funding for that. So I decided to do a pilot animatic because I felt like I could still get my story across and, you know, the vibe of the show and everything without having to raise that much money. It felt more reasonable.
And I guess there's an element of resilience too. You've got to be willing to be pragmatic and practical, but also, you know, roll with the punches, which is not always easy, particularly if you're younger and earlier in your career. Tell us about your book, because obviously you've pulled all of your experiences together. What are the sections in the book that you think about when someone says, tell us about your book? What are the sections that you think are really, really useful for someone who's navigating the developing an animated concept?
Well, I think my book is mainly focused on the actual process of developing a show. I talk a little bit about pitching and the different ways you can go towards the end, but It's largely about kind of unveiling that process and breaking it down in a way I think is pretty easy to follow. And I think what's special too about my book is I develop a show along with the reader. So I'm not just about the talk. I'm also walking the walk. So for every stage, you know, whether it's premise, characters, world, story engine, episodes, all the things you would expect to see in a pitch deck, I do that each stage for the show that I create in the book. And I don't come in to the book with an idea in mind. It kind of comes out through stream of consciousness, which I think is also a cool thing to see. And then at the end of the book, I have the pitch deck for the show I created.
Did you come to it partly with the idea in your head about what would be the kind of book that I'd have found really useful before I started my career in animation? Was that part of what was kind of guiding you?
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea what a pitch deck looked like when I was starting out. And also things like coming up with episodes for a show, that kind of thing is really difficult and something that comes with experience. So I thought if I can help at all, just get them started. I think that the book serves both experienced creators and people starting out. Depends, you know, you can get different uses out of it depending from where you're standing, I think. But yeah, it's just, I wanted to, like I said, just lift the veil. And so when I was writing it, I became pretty obsessive, like, oh, I should talk about this. I should talk about this. And eventually I was like, okay, I have to stop at some point, save it for the next book.
An important way to share knowledge that very often was passed down within the broader system that doesn't exist so much.
It's true.
Anymore. You learn a lot from your colleagues and your peers. You'd overhear things. You'd get chatting in the kitchen whilst making a cup of tea. But actually, that was a way of knowledge transfer. That now, because there's layoffs and shrinking back, and there's a lot of creators that will work for themselves, they'll be CEO of me for a long while. Actually, we need to find new ways to transfer that knowledge. So I think what you've done is really interesting in that way. Where do you think the root is? You know, new animation. Where do you think that's going to come from now in 2025?
Well, I'm really excited about. First, I was, for a long time, I was depressed because I had been working steadily from 2019 to 2023, and then it all kind of stopped. And so I was feeling just, you know, like I wasn't going to get any work. There was no way forward because I was just trapped in this disaster of an industry. But then realizing more and more and listening to podcasts like yours I have a friend who's working with different YouTube creators and was very encouraging. But I think that we're starting to see a bit of an even playing field for creators than there ever was before.
And what do you mean by that? What does that look like?
I mean their resources are becoming more available, you know, whether or not it's AI or Blender, you know, the best feature film at the Oscars for animation was Flow, you know, which was largely, I mean, he had a lot of resources and support, but it was made by one director.
Yeah, absolutely.
I find that encouraging.
And do you think that kind of almost more sole creator perspective on a series, do you think that's a kind of a viable option? Can you almost see, kind of going back to your experience with Pubertina, can you see that kind of sort of evolving into a kind of a viable strategy for creators?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's hard to do. It's hard to gain that much support and, you know, maintain the support. But people are doing it, and they're doing a lot better than the studios are. So, you know, it's like that kind of exciting thing. Even like you can compare it to when I started out in industry. And at the end of the tunnel, there was being a show creator and getting your own show with a studio. And now I think my goal is like being a self-made creator and finding different ways of, you know, getting income and making things happen. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's an exciting time.
I mean, in some ways, the shows that you've talked about, you already have that thing where you've kind of established them as their own show, even sometimes before the studio came on board. You've kind of established what they were about. So you can see how that could then evolve into almost being, so the Kickstarter thing. You could see how potentially if a creator can build a community of supporters and fans, then maybe there's a kind of a route to that being kind of more of an independent creator.
Yeah. And I think what we're probably going to see is, you know, more kind of studio or networks being built on YouTube, you know, where that like they're showing different creator shows on the same channel. Through someone who's doing really well. And I think we're seeing it already with like Glitch is producing Dana Terrace,
right's
new show.
I mean, in some ways, if you kind of go back to the origins of something like Nickelodeon, that started more from a sort of a grassroots kind of channel and then grew into something that was more corporate. You could almost see some of those YouTube channels having a sort of similar evolution, really.
Yeah, my hope would be, and I think this is what people want, is that creators retain most of the ownership of their creations.
Yeah, and I think hopefully that kind of route, the Kickstarter or the YouTube route, really kind of enables that, really, for them. Going back to your book on pitching, what would you say the most common misconception people have about developing and pitching a show is?
I think they aren't, for the people who are like have the confidence to even do it in the first place, I don't think they look at their ideas through enough lenses. I don't think they reflect enough on what's been done, what they're trying to say, what their point of view really is. And so that's why I make the strong point to do that in my book, that there are some litmus tests.
For doing that?
Sorry?
What is your process for doing that, for kind of really kind of holding that idea up to the light and looking at it from a couple of different perspectives?
Yeah, I try to feel around for an area that hasn't been tapped.
Right.
That is emerging as a meaningful, you know, discussion or point of view. And it's not forced. Like I have various ideas and they start forming, and then I'll be usually like happily surprised if I see how it can work with the current climate. And so with Goldie, you know, at the time, it was 2016 and I was feeling pretty squashed as a woman, to say the least. So my instinct was, I want to create a character who's a girl who takes up space. And that's where it was coming from. And that spoke to the environment we were in. And then, weirdly enough, when it came out on February 14th, it almost felt like a Brave show.
Right.
Just because it has a very diverse cast and it's promoting all these values that we seem to be moving away from in this country.
Right.
So it's interesting. Yeah.
And how long was that production process with Apple
pitch? It was like a 2-year, I think.
Right.
Production. It was a longer production schedule than most productions I've been on.
Right.
Because Mercury does really fantastic work and they want to hold their, you know, themselves to a certain standard.
Yep. I mean, it sounds like it couldn't be more of a contrast between like the YouTube schedule where you've got to kind of, how many episodes did you say you had to produce for that within what? What was the?
I had about 3 weeks for each episode.
Yeah. Was there anything that you enjoyed about that kind of high turnover?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the time I was fit for it because I was just out of animation school. I didn't have a partner, a family. I was living with some other artists. You know, I had the appetite for it. And I had nothing to lose. This was my opportunity. And I recognized that. Right. Yeah. So that kept me going. And it was fun to, I mean, the thing I like about TV is that you get to execute a story and then move on to the next one. And that was like that, but multiplied by 1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you kind of could explore almost a transmedia element to it as well by having the Twitter kind of account in that character's.
That was really fun. Boy. Yeah, I mean, looking back, like it kind of sucked that I didn't own the property and I was doing all of that. You know, like that's what I kind of want to move towards now. Be more critical of. Yeah,
and the Kickstarter show that you're doing, the vampire series, could you see kind of creating that kind of transmedia kind of viewpoint for that show as well, having maybe like a social media account or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, now that I'm a mother, and it's a lot harder to do all of that. You know, even I've been marketing my book on my own, doing a lot, and it's exhausting. But yeah, ideally, I'm actually building out a brand strategy document for Strawberry Vampire to show all the areas it could expand into. And, you know, I have my pipe dreams for it, for sure.
That's great. And the one final question that I had on that Kickstarter experience was that traditionally, I think people kind of approach development of a show where they feel like there's NDAs, I can't share anything with anyone, I'm going to present it to the studio.
Yeah.
I wonder what your thoughts were about that as a process and whether you think actually that might be a misconception that people have about developing shows that sometimes... Is there any benefit to kind of bring in an audience on that development journey with you?
If you own the material, then you should feel free. And in fact, you should be encouraged to share the process because that will help get people invested in your journey. And I think there's an aspect of that it's a personal journey that is really appealing to people. And helps the project resonate, you know. And that was a frustration for me for sure when I had developed all those shows and I couldn't share anything. And that's a frustration of many show creators. So that was part of my reason for doing the Goldie short initially.
Yeah.
Because I just wanted a calling card, something to share.
And people, I think people are just naturally fascinated by that process. And it always seems, in some ways, when people are developing stuff more for TV or for studios, that often it comes with quite a lot of secrecy about the show that you're developing. And I sometimes wonder whether actually just to kind of generate that interest and momentum, it might benefit them to be a bit more open about that process.
Yeah, I think people are unnecessarily cagey about their ideas. I mean, first of all, you can never control what studios are thinking and doing. I mean, for example, you could be developing a show that another studio is already producing, you know? So there's what's going to happen. Like, if consider the scenario that a studio steals one of your ideas, what, are you going to sue them?
Yeah, exactly. So,
like, what's the realistic, you know, consequence here? I think people should forget about that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There was a producer friend that I knew ages ago, and he, I think I asked him, how do you protect somebody from stealing your idea? And he goes, never show anyone. Then you can be guaranteed that nobody's going to steal it. But you're also guaranteed that it will never be made. So
yeah,
if you want to get it made, you've kind of got to relax a bit about that, I think.
Yeah, and it's just kind of silly. I don't know.
Well, that's great. I think that's a great place to end it on. Joe had to kind of drop out of the call. So if anyone's wondering where Joe went for the last 10 minutes, that's why.
No, I know she was in danger there.
I think she hasn't got locked into the room in the conference hall. So
she's fine. I'm glad she made it out.
Yes. But thanks so very much for kind of joining us, Emily.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andy. It's a real pleasure, and I can't wait for your next episodes. They're all so enjoyable.
That's great. It's really lovely to hear, and it's been really insightful and kind of a great, it's a great insight into kind of the process of developing and producing a show. So thanks again.
Oh, yeah, and you can buy your copy at www.emilybrundage.com. I'm selling it directly from my website right now. I haven't given it over to Amazon just yet, so. Please, check it out.
Yeah, and I can personally endorse it. I've already purchased my copy, and it was great. And I saw it got an endorsement from the creator of Bluey as well. Is that right?
Yes. Miraculously, I'm still in shock about it. But he read the book, and he sent a quote. You know that. Because he loved it and thought it would be so helpful to creators starting out. And he also sent me a personal note recently, which like blew my mind. He's such a nice guy.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Well, that kind of, you can't get a higher endorsement than that.
No, exactly. So what are you waiting for?
Exactly. That's great. Thanks very much, Emily.
Thanks, Andy.
And thanks to you guys for listening. And please like and subscribe and catch us next week.